The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Food, sinusitis, rhinitis, and drug allergy testing is presented by Dr. Timothy Craig.
Well, remember when you take your boards, there's a ENT kind of questions gathered. There's also dermatology type of questions, and then a lot of the generalist questions also go into this area. So I'm going to talk a little about rhinitis and the drugs of rhinitis, sinusitis and drugs with that, a little about food allergy, and then go into allergic skin disorders, which I'll continue in the next part. So I just wanted to briefly talk about this. Actually, my partner went through most of this, but I'm just going to mention a few aspects. So Jones-Coombs type 1, IgE mediated. B cells secrete the IgE under the influence of, what did you say, IL-4, 5, and 13. And then those IgE bind to mast cells, waiting for an antigen in the future. And that accounts for allergic rhinitis, asthma, food allergy, bee sting allergy, food allergy. Then you have a type 2 immune, where there's actually a fixed target, such as a platelet or a red blood cell. Here, the antibody is produced, IgG or IgM, binds to the target on a cell and destroys it, such as autoimmune hemolytic anemia, with the activation of complement with the antibody. Type 3 is more an immune complex phenomena. Here you have IgG, IgM, usually going under endothelial cells, activating complement as well, attracting neutrophils. And then the neutrophils come into that area and cause destruction of the tissues, very similar to what you see in some nephritises as well as in arthritis reactions and serum sickness. And then you have type 4, which is now unfortunately broken into many categories, but I'm only going to talk about the one that most people refer to. That is delayed hypersensitivity, mainly lymphocytes of the T helper 1, secreting IL-12, gamma interferon, IL-2, and causing all those changes that Brian talked about. So I just wanted to talk about that as just kind of the setting the principle for what I'll be going through now. So the cell type that is important, immediate hypersensitivity, is T helper 1, the T reg cell, T helper 2, or the T17 cell. So I think the obvious here is T helper 2. So just going through this, T helper 1 cells, mainly that type 4 reaction, gamma interferon, interleukin 12, interleukin 2, T reg cells shut down the immune system. T helper 2 cells are those that I was just talking about for immediate hypersensitivity, IgE mediated. They cause proliferation of mast cells, eosinophils, as well as the production of IgE from B cells or plasma cells. And then the T17 cell mainly activates neutrophils. I'm sorry, I went backwards. So the late phase of the immediate hypersensitivity, so I'm still talking about immediate hypersensitivity, the IgE reaction, the late phase is mainly due to what cell type? Neutrophils, eosinophils, mast cells, or T helper cells. And I think what happens, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, you have this. So this two bimodal type of situation, very important to remember in a variety of diseases, right? Asthma, especially occupation-induced asthma, also food allergy, bee sting allergy, any kind of anaphylaxis. So at first, when you challenge a person, this is looking at FEV1. Their FEV1, if they're allergic, will drop, mainly due to mast cells, muscle contractions. And then they have this late phase due to the influx of eosinophils or the inflammatory component. This occurs hours later, So very important if you have a food allergic person, they have anaphylaxis. Histamine's release causes all those symptoms. If you need to use many doses of epinephrine here, you know that the chances of having a late phase that might be severe is great. And so you might want to observe that person in the emergency room for 6 to 8 hours in case they have a severe late phase. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So this is just looking at difference of reactions. So here in the immediate, you see mainly the influence of histamine with some dilation of vessels causing the erythema and the induration from fluid moving into the interstitial space. And then in the late phase, you see more the induration of inflammatory cells, mainly eosinophils, moving into the tissue. So I did want to talk about allergic rhinitis, and you'd say, oh, this is internal medicine board. Why do I have to know about allergic rhinitis? But it is common, consumes a lot of money. About 30% of the population, 20% of the population has allergic rhinitis. Consumes a lot of resources in the United States, and I think it's very important for general internists to know about it. So the most common allergen that people are allergic to outside of a desert or a mountain area is A, cats, dogs, cockroaches, molds, or house dust mites. So since most people, the greatest majority of the population lives within 200 miles of a coastline, and that humidity as well as low elevation really breeds house dust mites, the answer would be E, house dust mites. When you get to Colorado, higher altitudes, lower humidity, cat antigen replaces the other, the house dust mites. Inner cities, cockroach, very important trigger for asthma. And molds, only in those that have water damage, but also you can see that indoor and outdoor is a trigger for asthma as well as allergic rhinitis. I did want to talk a little about the difference of allergic rhinitis. One's seasonal, and we'll go through that in a second. The other perennial. Perennial tends to be more severe, tends to be more associated with congestion. The drug of choice is usually a topical nasal steroid, which we'll talk about in a minute. We're allergic, seasonal, tend to be milder, tend to be more associated with ocular itch, sneezing, rhinorrhea. And then the drugs of choice vary depending on the symptom presentation, and we'll talk about them in a second. Not that I think you need anything to do with trees or pollen to identify them. But springtime symptoms, you need to think about tree allergies, such as what's happening here right now in Las Vegas. Trees are blooming. In late spring or early summer, most people would say summer, grass pollen becomes the predominant allergen. Then as you move into the fall, late summer, ragweed becomes the major allergen and accounts for symptoms up until mid-October. So the major perennial allergens are dust mite, cat, dog, indoor molds, mainly Penicillium and Aspergillus. The main seasonal allergens are trees, grasses, and ragweeds, and then some molds also in more agricultural areas. So a patient with active rhinitis, you take a smear of the nasal secretions. Which cell would you demonstrate on that histology? Would it be neutrophils? T cells, plasma cells, eosinophils, or epithelial cells? Actually, this is a poorly worded question when I'm looking at it now. So the answer would be eosinophils. You would also see some epithelial cells, though. So if you looked at a smear, this is what you see, mainly bilobed nucleuses, eosinophilic particles inside it. So that bilobed nucleus, eosinophilic or eosinophilic staining granules inside it, very typical of what you would see for an eosinophil, and that would be suggestive of allergic rhinitis or non-allergic with eosinophilia, which you can also see. So just going through the different skin tests we perform in allergy. There's the immediate hypersensitivity skin test. That is, you put an allergen on the skin. That's read in about 15, 20 minutes. It demonstrates whether or not there's pre-existing eosinophils on the mast cell. And it is very compatible with the symptoms you would see in both allergic rhinitis and sometimes asthma as well. If you look at why you should get, say, a prick test versus an intradermal test versus in vitro IgE testing, really in vitro IgE testing is more expensive than skin testing. Actually, the interpretation can be difficult, but the main thing is that they're mainly equal in sensitivity and specificity if you include both skin tests together. So that in vitro IgE testing is a viable, but it's more expensive, so obviously you wouldn't want to use large panels. So an indication for IgE skin testing is TB, sulfur allergy, bee sting allergy, or aspirin allergy. So the answer is C. So let's walk through them. Well, TB, now that's delayed hypersensitivity, right? PPD, you read in 2 days. Sulfur allergy, well, there's no good skin test for sulfur allergy. Aspirin sensitivity, well, we know that in most cases, rare to have IgE to aspirin. Most people actually have an increased production of leukotrienes, and that's what's causing it, so it's a drug adverse event, really, than IgE causing a reaction. So IgE skin testing is indicated for a variety of diagnoses: asthma, allergic rhinitis, food allergy, drug allergy, mainly penicillin, bee sting and fire ant allergy, eczema or atopic dermatitis, a better word, I should say, and then eosinophilic esophagitis, which we probably should add that into our discussions next year. So the highest risk for death from anaphylaxis to an allergy vaccine or skin testing is 1, severe asthma, B, bee sting anaphylaxis, 3, autoimmune disease, or D, pregnancy. It'd be severe asthma. The most fatalities associated with skin testing or immunotherapy have been people who have had unstable asthma at the time they've been skin tested. Actually, bee sting skin testing is no more dangerous than aeroallergen skin testing. Autoimmune disease really is a distractor totally. And pregnancy, obviously, because the uterus is a large, smooth muscle, you would never want to skin test somebody who's pregnant, with maybe the exception if they really needed penicillin for a particular diagnosis, such as meningitis from a variety of organisms. So, 22-year-old patient with severe asthma and rhinitis, his FEV1 is 55% predicted, so low. What test is contraindicated? Skin testing, DLCO, spirometry, ENO, or lung volumes with helium? So I think hopefully you would all get that, kind of touched on it in the last lecture too, is skin testing. If someone has severe asthma or a significant decrease in their FEV1, you would not want to give them an allergy injection or immunotherapy, nor would you want to skin test them because of increased risk for fatality. DLCO, you can do at any lung volume, at any lung severity. Most respiratory techs don't really enjoy doing spirometry in those that are pretty sick, but you can do it. Spirometry is the choice here, obviously. It would be safe to do. I'm sorry, let me take that back. It's contraindicated, right? Spirometry would obviously you could do. ENO you could definitely do, and lung volumes with helium you could definitely do. So the answer would be skin testing. So the contraindications for skin testing, which are also the same for immunotherapy: unstable asthma, for skin testing, dermatographia, because you could not interpret the results. If they've had severe anaphylaxis during a skin testing procedure before, you probably don't want to pursue another one. If they're on non-selective beta blockers, there are exceptions to that. Maybe if they have a drug allergy or bee sting allergy and they can't get off this non-selective beta agonist, the risk may be worthwhile. FEV1 below 70 because, again, severity of asthma. Pregnancy, as I already told you about. Severe eczema, only because there's not enough skin to really read a test or to place a test. And then if you're in an office where you can't treat anaphylaxis, that would be a contraindication to doing skin testing or give an allergy vaccine. So let's look at therapy for rhinitis. The best therapy for congestion associated with rhinitis is topical cromolyn, cetirizine, which is a non-sedating or low-sedating antihistamine, montelukast, which is a leukotriene receptor antagonist, topical fluticasone, or topical azelastine, the latter being an antihistamine. Obviously, fluticasone is a topical steroid. So let's look at the answer. So it would be D, right? So topical crumulin really has only one use. That is, if you go into your mother-in-law's who got a cat to keep you out of their house, then you might want to use crumulin before going in there. Outside of that, it has really no other benefit. Cetirizine, well, cetirizine works very good as an antihistamine, but antihistamines don't really affect congestion, and we'll talk about that in a second. Montelukast, again, for congestion, not as good. You get a little bang for your dollar with that, but topical steroids are much better. And then topical azelastine, again, gives you a little benefit, but topical steroids are much better for congestion. Thus, your answer. I'm going to skip over this one because it's hard for you to read. Instead, I have it this way. So diagnoses of rhinitis and treatment preference. So you have year-round allergies or perennial allergies. Topical nasal steroids are the drug of choice. If you have non-allergic rhinitis, topical nasal steroids, again, are your drug of choice. Topical antihistamines may be an alternate therapy. If you have gustatory rhinitis, that is rhinorrhea and cough after eating, that's a person that may be served well with ipratropium bromide. If you have mild seasonal allergic rhinitis, non-sedate and antihistamines, probably your drug of choice. If you have pre-exposure to prevent an allergy, that's when crumulin may be a benefit. With asthma, and they have mild asthma, then you might want to try montelukast as your initial treatment. And if you have severe allergic rhinitis, obviously nasal steroids are the drug of choice. Instead, looking at symptoms and treatment, congestion, nasal steroids, itchy mucosa, antihistamines, excessive secretion, nasal steroids, topical antihistamines, or anticholinergics. That's the only thing anticholinergics are indicated for is excessive secretion, such as gustatory. Severe symptoms, nasal steroids. Poor sleep, nasal steroids. Severe congestion, nasal steroids. And uncontrolled rhinitis with uncontrolled despite medications, that would be immunotherapy. So immunotherapy is indicated for which diagnoses? Eosinophilic esophagitis, urticaria, sinusitis, asthma, hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So let's look at the answer here. So it would be asthma. So eosinophilic esophagitis, there's no data suggesting immunotherapy would work in this disease. Urticaria, again, no data suggesting, and in fact, most urticaria that's chronic is autoimmune and not allergen related, so it shouldn't work. Sinusitis, well, you might treat rhinitis, maybe hopefully get some benefit for sinusitis. So I guess you could say that could be a legitimate answer as well. Asthma, though, but there is good data supporting that you decrease the amount of medications necessary for asthma as well as decrease symptoms with immunotherapy when you treat asthma. And then hypersensitivity pneumonitis, that is not a type 1 disease, so you wouldn't expect to have any benefit in hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So a 26-year-old man, or a 26-year-old, with rhinitis and asthma, is 8 weeks pregnant. Couldn't be a man, could it? Which below would you discontinue from her regimen? Immunotherapy, fluticasone nasal spray, cetirizine, oral decongestions, or montelukast. So if we walk through them, immunotherapy, you can continue during pregnancy. You wouldn't want to start it nor increase the dose because of the risk of anaphylaxis. Fluticasone nasal spray, very appropriate, class B. Cetirizine, very appropriate to use, class B. Montelukast, very appropriate to use, class B. Some oral decongestions, really, though, on a chronic basis, probably should not be used. And there's a couple antihistamines, but none of them are used in this day and age anyway. So the answer, I think, would be stopping the oral decongestion. So I think I've gone through immunotherapy and basically skin test in two, and then I'll move into the next topic in a second. So indications, asthma, allergic conjunctivitis, bee sting allergy, fire ant allergy, allergic rhinitis, drug allergy, and atopic dermatitis. Contraindications, unstable asthma, severe, not severe, but impinged FEV1 or peak flow, prior severe anaphylaxis to that substance, unable to treat anaphylaxis in your office, non-selective beta blockers, and build-up therapy during pregnancy. So one last thing about immunotherapy. How long should a person be on allergy vaccine? 1 to 2 years, 2 to 3, 3 to 5, 5 to 10? Well, again, good New England Journal article demonstrated 3 to 5. So this is, quickly walk you through this. You can see the green. These are people who are on placebo. They get worse every spring. I'm sorry, late spring, early summer from grass allergy. See the blue, those who are treated. 3 years later, those blues are divided into two groups. One stays on active therapy, one goes on placebo. And look at the pink and yellow, that's the divided group. You can see they're both just as good. So immunotherapy seems to have a lasting effect after the use of 3 years or 5 years. Most of the other studies suggest 5 years. So 3 or 5 years would be the answer. Allergic conjunctivitis. Nasal, topical nasal steroids do work. Oral antihistamines, non-sedating, hopefully, do work. Intranasal antihistamines do work. Probably the best, though, would be an antihistamine, a mast cell stabilizer, for ocular symptoms that fail to resolve with the usual therapies of the rhinitis. Drug-induced rhinitis is always kind of important and often sought. The answers are often looked for in questions on a board, and that is those drugs that can cause rhinitis-type symptoms includes angiotensin-converting enzymes, prostadiesterase 5 selective inhibitors, phosphodiesterase, I'm sorry. Beta blockers can cause increased congestion. Aspirin and non-steroidals in select people who are aspirin sensitive. The two drugs that can cause rebound phenomena after they're stopped are adrenergic decongestants as well as cocaine. So this is kind of an interesting board question too. So you have a patient has unilateral rhinitis, or rhinorrhea, I should say. Unilateral, that's very unusual for rhinitis, right? It's refractory to therapy. You talk to them, you find that they had a history of head trauma, or maybe an automobile accident, or some surgery, and that would make you think that maybe it's cerebral spinal fluid rhinorrhea. The two ways of diagnosing that is looking at glucose. Glucose is in spinal fluid, as you all know, but is not in nasal secretion, so it's positive for glucose. It's likely to be spinal fluid. Also, beta-2 transferrin is in spinal fluid, but not in nasal secretions. So you could use either one of those tests to determine if a person has unilateral rhinorrhea to see if it has anything to do with spinal fluid. The true statement about sinusitis is clinicians continue to overprescribe antibiotics for acute sinusitis. There's a lack of efficacy of intranasal corticosteroids in sinusitis. Antibiotics are usually effective for chronic sinusitis, and antibiotics are necessary for most cases of acute sinusitis. Well, I think we probably all know this because it's pounded into us on a regular basis. Clinicians continue to overprescribe antibiotics for acute sinusitis. Nasal steroids do have a benefit for sinusitis, so that would be an inappropriate distractor. Antibiotics are usually effective for chronic sinusitis. That's not true, unfortunately, so that would be a negative distractor. And antibiotics are necessary for most cases of acute sinusitis. Obviously, that's not the answer. The most common organism in acute sinusitis is staph, pneumococcal, rhinovirus, and beta strep. Well, you have to know that answer if you know that acute sinusitis shouldn't be treated with antibiotics, right? So it'd be rhinovirus. The majority of acute sinusitis is viral-induced. The number one virus is rhinovirus. The first-line agent in acute bacterial sinusitis, and now we're talking about bacterial sinusitis, is a sulfa drug with trimethoprim, amoxicillin, clarithromycin, azithromycin or amoxicillin with clavulinic acid? Kind of a difficult answer here, and it depends on which guidelines you read. Jeez, maybe we need a new battery in this. If you read general practice guidelines from FPs, it would be amoxicillin. If you read the guidelines from ENT, it'd be amoxicillin plus clavulinic acid. So it depends on who you read. I think the better answer here would be E, and this is why. So strep pneumoniae, Haemophilus, and Moxiella, all of them are quite resistant against penicillin. You can see about close to 50% of H flu. You can see that most of Catarrhalis is now resistant, and a good portion of strep pneumoniae. So I would say a better therapy would be amoxicillin with clavulinic acid. So the treatment of choice for acute sinusitis, nasal steroids work. Nasal lavage works. You can get some decrease in symptoms with decongestions. When they're refractory or symptoms reoccur 7 to 10 days later, that's when you think about Augmentin. If someone's penicillin allergic, the drug of choice is then doxycycline. For chronic sinusitis, we have a totally different thing. The main part of chronic sinusitis is inflammatory, and in fact, just like asthma, a good portion of them have inflammation, that's T helper 2, and will not go away no matter how many antibiotics you use. The organisms are often mixed, anaerobe, staph, and often, not often, but in some cases, more fungal in origin. So there is some question whether or not antibiotics even have a benefit, even though in most cases people try multiple courses of antibiotics with chronic sinusitis, often without any benefit. So nasal polyps. Nasal polyps in the adults suggest which disease? Sensitivity to aspirin, cystic fibrosis, maxillary sinusitis, or ciliary dyskinesia? So the answer would be A, sensitivity to aspirin. Now grant you, cystic fibrosis, people do have nasal polyps, and since people live until the third decade and fourth decade of life, you will see that. In ciliary dyskinesia, almost every one of them have nasal polyps, but that's much more rare, those two diagnoses, than is sensitivity to aspirin. And maxillary sinusitis wouldn't be an answer. Most nasal polyps arise from ethmoidal sinuses, not maxillary sinuses. So nasal polyps may or may not be allergic. They're almost always associated with eosinophils. 15% of those people who have nasal polyps will have aspirin sensitivity. 25% will go on to develop asthma. The treatment of choice is nasal steroids because they overproduce leukotrienes, montelukast, and aspirin desensitivity, if they are sensitive to aspirin, works. So in youth, if you see nasal polyps, you think about cystic fibrosis. In adults, you think about aspirin sensitivity. So aspirin sensitivity, as I said earlier, is not IgE. What happens, they have excessive amount of productions of leukotrienes because when you give non-steroidals or aspirin, you block cyclooxygenase, you decrease production of prostaglandin E2, increased production of D2, that leads to decreased inhibition of leukotriene pathway, leading to increased leukotrienes that cause worsening of the asthma, sinusitis, and rhinitis. Again, 15% of asthmatics have aspirin sensitivity. The treatment is treatment of choice is avoidance of aspirin and non-steroidals. They often present with Sampson's triad, where you see nasal polyps, aspirin sensitivity, chronic sinusitis, rhinitis, and asthma. And if you take asthma and non-steroidals, you can also get some angioedema of the face, erythema of the nose and cheeks, as well as inflammation of the eyes in those people. The treatment of choice, as I said, is avoidance. You can still use acetaminophen as long as you use under 1,000 milligrams. You can also use COX-2 inhibitors. You can also desensitize people with aspirin sensitivity Once they do that, though, they need to stay on aspirin or nonsteroidals for the rest of their life. If they do stop them for more than 3 days, they need to be re-desensitized.